Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It is time to begin the TechNet, as we do almost every single Sunday night for the last 32 years. Started September 1982. 32 years ago. This is TechNet number 1,524 of the series. And some people think that it's a bit of a record to have one particular leadership run a net of that many hours for that many years for this length of time. I think it's a record. People gather at this particular spot at this particular time because they're curious. They want to know more about wireless equipment, radio. How does that transmitter receiver really work? How does that transmission line really work? How does that antenna really work? What's going on with propagation? There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. It's a vast series, a vast field. Radio itself is a vast field. From my point of view, it is rather poorly taught in our higher educational institutions. The wireless technology, the computer science, yeah, very well taught. But the wireless part of it, that curriculum was set in 1947, and they haven't really updated it very much since. So the bottom line is that if you want an antenna designer, if you want a person who understands radio, wireless equipment, more than half the time you are forced into hiring a ham radio operator. That's the only way you can get a person who's got the passion, the knowledge, the experience, because with hands-on techniques he has learned, and by talking to his buddies, what does the average ham do? He tells each other what the weather is like and what equipment he's using, what equipment he has changed, how much better it's working. We're continuously passing information back and forth using the radio itself. So this is where the experts are coming from a good percentage of the time. When I say this is the where, I'm talking about ham radio itself. A certain percentage of those people, yes, got their start from the TechNet. John and I, and before that was Mel, K2KEY, we would periodically get a few emails per year from people who said, I had a scanner, I was tooling around, I heard this thing called the technical net, I heard these people having an awful lot of fun, I decided to go get a ham radio license. I'm awful glad I did. We get a few of those letters per year. So we're doing a little bit of evangelizing, I see, indirectly. Let me drop. And by way of the recent changes made to the system by people like Eric KE2EJ, who added IRLP and Echolink, this particular net gets connected to quite a few other places around North America and a few other countries. So occasionally we get check-ins from pretty far off. The majority of the operation over the last 32 years has been primarily the New York City area, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Connecticut, and most of Long Island. That's where this particular repeater is located, and that's where all that brain power was coming from during most of those years. Now, by way of those internet connections that Eric has provided, we're going a little bit further. As such, when a tough question comes along, quite often a person from one of those outer areas, as well as one of the brain centers, as I call them, of New York City area, will come along and say, I've got some experience in that area. This is what I did. And I'm going to tell you what worked for me. And that's an awful lot of the information that gets passed over the TechNet is of that form. Let me drop it. We have a very loose schedule. I intentionally insist that the TechNet not be highly regimented, completely controlled. We go with the flow. Our very loose schedule is that for the first hour we take questions and give quasi-brief answers. That's followed by John going to the mailbag. John is KC2WGB, and he gets as many as 250 emails on some particular weeks where people don't yet have their ham license, don't yet have the ability to talk to us directly, don't yet have the right equipment, and they send us a question, and we try our best to answer those. After the mailbag, we go over to our space expert, which is Paul, WS2N, who for the last quite a number of years has been telling us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as well as the European and the space agencies, what are they doing. It seems like Paul has quite a passion to keep track of everything that goes up into space. And everything is getting ready to go up in space. He's been doing it for... it's his raison d'etre, as I see it. Just like I think my raison d'etre is to design antennas, which is something I've been involved in for the last 35 years. Let me drop. So as you can tell, I just love the antenna questions when they come along. And after our first hour or so, followed by the mailbag for half hour or so, followed by the space report, after that, if there's enough enthusiasm left, we go into deeper subjects. Some people don't like that stuff, the so-called deeper subjects. Well, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. You know what's coming. During that first hour, people check in with their call letters, the name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment for the net. We drop. And do try to remember in between each transmission to listen for all four beeps. It's very easy to think that, they're calling on the list of names that have checked in. They're coming to my name right now. You get a little bit excited and you jump the gun and don't wait for the four beeps. You could time out portions of the machine where they won't hear us on the link machine out to Eastern Long Island, the 147.375 machine. This particular machine is the Limelight Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club 146.85 machine. It's the one that is the main one that you're listening to. And so you can time out various portions of the system, the internet connections as well as the linked, if you jump the gun. So try to remember to listen for the four beeps. As I said before, you don't have to check in if you're just listening, because after 32 years, we believe people are listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So please check in if you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WA2PJF, Vito. And yes, he's one of our frequent sign-ins, and one of our experts with reference to Home Depot products, among other things. He also has an extensive background with the Marbell system. So, give me your call letters and name, and that word yes right now, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2LIW listening.
Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform Attempt, yes.
And to be rich and with a question.
Okay, so far we've got Tim and Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time.
Kilo 2 Charlie X-ray, Steve, yes.
Why in the world would Steve have a question for us? I'm having some fun with him. He's our technical advisor for the area. Very fine. Glad to hear from you, Steve. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
6DPZ with quickie answers.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that Hal, K6DPZ, gives the more compact answers from his experience of a lot of ham radio equipment over a whole lot of years. Quite often I follow that with my longer answers. We don't ask anymore, do people want the long answer or the short answer? Sometimes they get both. They usually don't complain. Anyone else to check in with your call letters and name, because you've got a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters right now.
WS2N, Paul with the space report. Good evening, everybody.
There's that space expert. We're looking forward to hearing from him, because NASA is doing some great things. And I make jokes from time to time that I make sure that I eat a lot of vegetables and get some exercise, because I want to live long enough to see some of those spacecraft. Like, for instance, the A New Horizons, the thing that's going all the way out to Pluto, and for the first time going to do a flyby of Pluto. Guarantee they're going to see things you never anticipated. Anyone else to check in? One last call. Give me your call letters and name if you got a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW. Listen for the four beeps. Okay. Maybe we'll pick up some people later. We got more than enough to get going. And we tend to adjust. If we get a whole lot of check-ins, everybody gets a briefer answer. If we get very few check-ins, we dig a little deeper. And sometimes those digger deepers have turned up some exciting information. So, Tim, Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Victor Uniform. We'll discuss anything except antennas. That's a joke. You got it, Tim.
Good evening to you, Dick, and good evening to the net. And just got a... quick question. I was doing some experiment this afternoon with, newly built log periodic antenna that I'm, you know, I made for digital TV, but it can be also transmit on the 440 megahertz, and SWR is pretty all right on the 440. It's about 1.2, 1.1 to 1. But I was trying to plot the antenna pattern, you know, but my setup is I'm using a SDR USB dongle as a receiver, because that way I can raise the dBm on the receiving, and I use the QRP radio transmit into a dummy load, and the distance between the antenna and the dummy load is about I would say about less than 5 feet. It's in my room, and I was turning my antenna around. You know, the increment is 30 degrees, and then I write, you know, I put the dBm I'm seeing on the receiver and into an Excel file, and I use another program called a Polar Plot, and I plot the pattern that way. So my question is, because I've seen some videos of people testing antennas, they use a dipole as a transmitting antenna and then turn the receiving antenna, which is the testing object, and turn the antenna in, you know, 10 degrees, whatever increments. My question is, do I really need to make a dipole?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The chamber. So, back to you, Dick. K2RIW in the net, KD2AVU.
Hey, you timed out the machine because you went beyond about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, Tim. Not to worry. I was listening on the input. I heard everything you said. Okay, you're getting heavy into antenna plotting. Beautiful field. And, oh boy, there's a zillion different ways of doing it. You led me to believe that because you've set up your range to be only 5 feet long, and whenever you transmit over a 5 foot distance to a typical radio receiver, a reasonably good radio receiver on VHF, UHF frequencies has a sensitivity in the vicinity of half or a quarter of a microvolt. And if you're transmitting over a 5 foot distance instead of a 5 mile distance, so to speak, because of the so-called inverse square law, in other words, every time you double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of power, because you're so extremely close. Yes, you're using a dummy load as a method of cutting down the signal strength, is what I think you're doing. And your thinking is that the leakage from the dummy load is what you're picking up 5 feet away as you're plotting that antenna pattern we drop. And if you used a real dipole or a horn or some other kind of typical source antenna for an antenna range, when the if you're using the full receiver sensitivity without putting a pad in front of the receiver, you would be transmitting an amount of power of, you know, 1/1000th of a milliwatt, a microwatt, would be more than enough power over 5 feet to give you a strong signal. You're using the leakage of the dummy load. Well, when you use the leakage of a dummy load, it could be all right or it could be giving you confusing results. When I put my signal into a dummy load and I go around with a sensitive sniffing device, a small antenna on the end of a piece of a cable, and I find out where the signal is coming from. If my dummy load is a high-quality one, very little signal is being radiated by it. Some of the signal is being radiated by the transmission line, the connectors on the end of the transmission line, the box of the transmitter itself, the power supply for the transmitter, the 110-volt cable going into the wall, might be part of the radiating system. So when you have a well-shielded thing like a dummy load, it's not easy to figure out what is doing the emitting. And because your emitting might be coming from multiple places that I just described, the antenna pattern you'll see will get a heck of a lot more complicated and be a little bit more difficult to interpret. Can we drop? A more conventional technique would be an intentionally leaky dummy load. In other words, if your transmitter could run at the 5 milliwatt level, so to speak, and you put a 50-ohm resistor, an actual carbon resistor with the two leads, at the tail end of a transmission line, so it's not even very well shielded, just the quarter-inch length or the half-inch length of the 50-ohm resistor at the end of the transmission line, that would make an extremely good, very near-field transmitting antenna. It'll radiate a signal that's hundreds times faster and louder than the signal being radiated by the box. So having your dummy load well shielded could be hurting you a little bit. Another thing to worry about is that you're trying to get a rough approximation right now as to what is the pattern out of your log periodic antenna. And to make that measurement indoors is also going to make your life a little bit more complicated. Outdoors, you're going to get slightly better results. In your mind, you see the signal coming from your transmitting site over to the log periodic antenna and going into the receiver. Let me drop. And in your mind, you see that direct signal, as we all do. However, whenever you transmit any signal from any antenna, one of the things that's good and both bad is that when you transmit a signal, it goes to every cubic meter or cubic inch of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. So some of that signal coming out of your transmitting device, or in your case, it may be the cable and the box of the transmitter and so on, it is bouncing off your file cabinet, the floor, the ceiling, the wiring that's in the wall, the plumbing that's in the house. It's bouncing off of everything. Yeah, the direct signal is going to be the slightly stronger one because it's got the shorter path. But all those other paths are there, and that complicates the apparent antenna pattern. You'll get a slightly cleaner antenna pattern if you do it outdoors on a flat field with a few other objects around for the nearest 20 feet or so. You'll get a much cleaner pattern, a little closer to the truth. And whenever you put things like that at an outdoor antenna range, the one thing you never can stop is the ground reflection. Let me drop. Now, when you're only measuring the antenna horizontal pattern of a horizontally polarized log periodic, that could be more than good enough. But if you try to measure the vertical pattern when you're getting ground reflection, life gets much more complicated. If you go to the antenna handbook or the antenna manual of ARRL, and you go to the section called Transmission Lines and Measurements, and Antenna Measurements, and in the back of that chapter, you'll find an article by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, a genius of a guy that used to work for Bell Labs, a good friend of mine. I'm very unhappy he's no longer around, but he wrote this beautiful article on what I call the reflective ground plane range technique of doing antenna pattern measurement. So he'll teach you that there are certain specific heights that you should use for the antenna under test and the source antenna in order to get a cleaner antenna pattern in the presence of ground plane. Your ground is always going to be giving you a reflection. This is the best of all worlds. You put your transmitter and receiver in free space, you know, 100 miles above the Earth. You'd be a mile back behind the space shuttle floating in your space suit while you're doing this this antenna measurement. That would be a clean environment. Well, of course you don't have that. And I'm not talking about the extremes. Now, you've got to decide how much accuracy do you want of your pattern. If your pattern is accurate to the nearest dB or two, and if the main lobe and the side lobe and the back lobe are within a few dB of what they really are, you're home free. It's a beautiful science experiment. There's also, once you know the design of your particular log periodic antenna, let me drop. There are articles that will tell you what kind of a pattern you should be getting. The fact that you're getting a standing wave ratio of 1.2 is fantastic. The good news about a log periodic, and by the way, there's a zillion designs of log periodic. Some of them planar, some of them are spatial, some of them are spirals, some of them are wrapped on conic surfaces. The word log periodic is sort of like the word Christian. You know, there's 450 brands of Christianity recognized in the United States. I could probably find you 50 different antenna designs that are called log periodic, so there's a lot of them out there. You do enough searching to find somebody who will give you information that has been measured on your antenna. Also, there are computer modeling programs where you can predict the pattern by way of the computer modeling program. And on log periodics, they usually do a pretty good job. So you're in a beautiful area. It's a great science experiment. There's all kinds of ways of doing it simple and just get vague answers, and you can take it as far as you want, and you get answers that are more and more accurate as you use better and better equipment, better and better location, and eventually your answers become traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. You decide how far you want to go with that. And please come back periodically, Tim, and tell us how it goes and what you've discovered so far. Beautiful experiment. KD2, AVU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. K2IW in the net, KD2AV returning. Yeah, this is my own design. The design, the receiving is from 400 to almost 1 gig, you know, because I wanted to cover as much as I can on this antenna. But you know, when I put the antenna into the simulator, antenna design into the simulator program, you know, like, I want this antenna can be used on transmitting antenna on 440 and 900 meg. So that's the design goal. But I'm not sure about 900, but at least 440 is working, you know, transmitting. And that's, today's measurement was on 443 megahertz. So, maybe later when I get a 900 meg equipment, got the 900 megahertz equipment, I can do some more testing with it. But that's it for now. But I'm definitely looking for a more accurate result on my measurement. And so, yeah, maybe I should take it outside someday. Anyways, thanks, Dick. And back to the net. K2RW, KD2AVU.
Yeah, from my point of view, Tim, the really smart scientist-like people that are into electronics are studying antennas. It's just my particular biased point of view. From my point of view, real radio equipment really requires an antenna. You can have a gold-plated transmitter, a silver-plated receiver that's a Rolls-Royce brand, and if you don't connect it to an antenna, you've got nothing. So from one point of view, I could say that real radio communication consists of a good transmitting antenna, a good receiving antenna, and once you've got those, you hang some electronics on them. That's my particular point of view. So, by the way, I spent the last 10 years of my life doing 915 megacycle antenna designs. If you go to the U.S. Postal and Patent Office, and you look up my last name, and you put in my address, Dick Sills, Long Island, you have to do that because there's another guy out there who is a distant cousin of mine who's got the exact same last name, who has filed a zillion patents on the subject of printed circuit techniques. And so you look at my name and you'll find 30, I think it's about 28 or 30, maybe it's 32, something like 32 patents, applications on my name. Over 26 of them have been issued. Many of them are 915 megacycle, relatively broadband antennas. The good news about a log periodic, properly built, is it's got a lot of bandwidth with reasonably low standing wave ratio. That's the good news. The bad news is rarely does a log periodic go beyond about 6 or 7 decibels of gain. So when you decide that you really like the 432 band or the 440 band or the 915 meg band, you might eventually want to design for yourself a much higher gain antenna. Let me drop it. Like a medium long or a very long Yagi. A Yagi antenna properly built can easily give you 16 dB of gain, maybe even beyond. Some of them go as high as 20 and 22 dB of gain on one single boom, well-designed long Yagi. That's the good news. The bad news is they'll cover a major portion of the 440 band or a 432 band, or they'll cover almost all of the 915 band, but they won't go between the bands. So you pay your money and take your choice. You get higher gain over narrow bandwidth, or you can get broad bandwidth with a log periodic, but much lower gain. And so when it comes to long-range communication, you'd like your antenna to have high gain, you'd like it to be high up in the air, you'd like to have very low feed line loss, you'd like to have a low noise preamplifier to receive very weak signal. You put that all together on the 432 meg band, on single sideband, you could, with a reasonable location, as long as you're not in the bottom of a valley somewhere, you could talk with a Yagi antenna mounted on the chimney of the house. Most days you'll talk to the guys in New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, most of the time Virginia, out to New Jersey, Pennsylvania, to the north you'll talk to guys in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, occasionally Maine, occasionally Nova Scotia and Canada. One single Yagi, 432, 100 watts of power, single sideband. Those are the kinds of ranges you can get many days of the year with reasonable propagation. you compare those results on 2 meter FM, the good news is nice and channelized and a lot of people to talk to, but the range is a very small fraction of that kind of range you can get out of good equipment on single sideband. So antenna experiments are where it's really at. And the higher the antenna, the better they work on VHF frequencies. Good luck with that project, Tim. You're on a good one. And let us know periodically how it goes. Rich, N2EO, what's going on in Massapequa Park? N2EO, K2RW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, good evening, Dick. N2EO, how you doing, Dick? And got a computer question. It's more of a, let me just put it this way. I think it's okay. I said to Patty I want to get a printer, a new printer for Christmas, which is not that far away. And usually what they charge you is a bottom line price on the printer, and they get you on the ink. Now, I've tried refilling cartridges, and quite frankly, made a mess out of the place when it was back in Whitestone. So I wanted to get a recommendation from somebody or some number of people on some company, maybe Hewlett-Packard or one of the other companies that doesn't rob you on cartridges. I know they all get more than the worst, but one of the more moderately priced. The printer I had was a Kodak. The problem with the Kodak, they advertise the lowest price anywhere on ink cartridges for that machine. But the problem, what I found out, was the reason they were low price was on the Kodak, you don't get a new head when you change the cartridge. The head stays in the machine. Well, so it's two pieces. What was happening was the heads would plug up, and I'd have to spend $30 whenever for heads. So I finally got disgusted. When we moved here, it went in the garbage. So I wonder who recommends a good printer with a color inkjet that's not going to run me ragged on ink.
Yeah, you've asked the wrong guy when it comes to me, K2LIW. I'm light on that knowledge. My computer expert in the house is my son, KB2IQN, who selects all of our printers and our repeat and our computers and our power supplies for them, and the Linux Debian operating system and whatever. And as that system fails, I'm in a heap of trouble. I'd like to believe that Consumer Reports has done some reading of printers, because that's a vast area. But when you and I walk into a store that sells computing equipment, you'll find a zillion printers. Some of them are and some are not compatible with your particular operating system and the rest of your hardware. Some of them have got expensive cartridges. Some of them have got high resolution. Some of them have got color. Inkjet is one way. The highest resolution, I think, is laser printer, color laser printers. And some of
Dick, Chris is on EchoLink.
Okay. Chris, fantastic. I'm glad we got him out of the woodwork. Give us some words on this one, Chris. KB2IQN, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, for whatever reason, Chris is not coming through right now. You're saying you saw him on EchoLink, John. Give us a few words, John, as to how you think Chris is connected at this time, and should he be able to talk to us? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I see he's posted. He's in attendance. Maybe he's not listening. That's something else, but I thought if you gave him a call, maybe he could answer the question. Good question, though.
If you want. Yeah, we're looking for answers. So KB2IQN, if somebody can go wake him up. He's a real TX station to me. He is, let me think now. He's 50 feet from where I am, but there's a couple of rooms in between us. Eric? Yes, I did. We need him. And for the my wife is going to find Christopher and wake him up, so to speak. And Eric, tell us what you know about printers, because I'm sure you've used a lot of them. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
It's difficult when you live in a mansion, huh?
I wish it was a mansion.
Anyway, I have a very simple answer for Rich. Killer Packard makes a printer. That's $45. And it comes with the cartridges. And when it runs out of ink, what you do is you go buy another one. Because the cartridges cost almost exactly the same as the printer. That's just the way it is. And as far as interfacing to machines today, pretty much there's universal drivers. Whatever operating system you have to deal with it. The two big ones, of course, are Windows and Macintosh, OS X. But there's drivers for Linux, there's drivers for Unix, there's drivers for ISIS. When you're buying from Hewlett Packard, they cover all their bases like that. But literally, the cost of the printer is less expensive than the cartridge. When you buy the new one, it comes with a cartridge, so, you know, take it as you want. It's YWK2J. I mean, there's a zillion printers out there. By the way, inkjet printers actually have, there are some that have more resolution than the laser printers. Sounds unbelievable, but it's true. Back to you, Dave.
I was just told that Chris is investigating the situation. A $45 printer, inkjet-like printer you talked about, with cartridge and everything else ready to roll. Sounds too good to be true, Eric. I'm glad you're giving us enough audio, by the way. Bear in mind now that Rich made a specific request. He's looking for a color printer with a reasonable resolution. I'm guessing he wants to be able to reproduce photographs, among other things. I'm having great trouble believing that that printer you're describing for $45 was color, but maybe it was. Give us some more words on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's color. It's native resolution. It's 600 dpi. The software resolution can be 2400 dpi. It's color. And if you want to make photographs, you know, use shiny paper. You can get nice pictures out of it. Now, it's not as good as high-end is designed for doing photographs. You know, that'll be like, 426 dpi or 4023, sorry. And even their high-end printers, they don't go past like $100-$200. But, you know, if you're talking laser printers, they have really cheap laser printers, and they have more expensive laser printers, but you know, for a 45, I've seen it as low as 45. I think it's normally about 60. But, it's a very good printer. What can I tell you?
That $45/$60 printer, what brand name is that, Eric? Second of all, do you know of any particular website, magazine, Consumers Report, or whatever, that has done some kind of a spreadsheet rating of printers, quality versus price versus size versus the price of the cartridges? Do you know of anybody who has done a rating of printers? But that $45 or $60 printer, what brand name is that? Maybe I'm going to go get one of those because I'd like to have color printing. I've got high resolution black and white with expensive cartridges, a Hewlett Packard machine. I really would like to have some color. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
As I said before, it was Hewlett Packard. And you can literally buy it in Staples or Office Depot. Actually, sometimes the prices in Staples are cheaper than Microcenter. Actually, Microcenter used to be cheap. They seem to be jacking the prices up lately. The printer, I think, is made in China. But then again, what is it? And, you know, it's coming from HP. Take it out of the box, plug it in, the freaking thing works. What can I tell you?
Now that I think back, you did say Hewlett Packard, and it ran right by me, and I didn't believe it. What is the price of the cartridge for that machine? And if the machine runs out and stops working for $45 or $60, you just go out and buy another one every 2 years, every year and a half, or whatever. Wow. Do they sell the cartridge for that machine, Eric? And if I marry myself to that machine, and I learn all of its quirks, and all of its software interfacing characteristics and whatever, I'd like to believe that Hewlett Packard is going to continue manufacturing that for a while so I can buy another one when I need it. or is it just on sale? Is it one of these deals where they're selling the machine cheap because they know they're going to make a fortune selling you cartridges? You see, I got a bunch of crazy questions here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the Tech Net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, your package actually comes out with a new line every year, every 2 years. They've always had, actually, I'll get you the exact model number, the one that I'm talking about. They've always had a low price printer. That's pretty reasonable. And they continue to do that. So, you know, I mean, the line might be there for a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years. But then there's a more modern equivalent that usually has more features. So, you know, they don't just stand still.
Do they sell a cartridge for that machine?
WS2N.
They sell cartridges for that machine. And literally, you know, you pick up the machine at 45 or 50 bucks, and you find out the cartridges for it, and you buy all, you know, the color and the black and white, you're spending about 35, 40 bucks. So sometimes it's like, well, why even bother to buy the cartridges? Just get it out of the machine. It's perfectly in alignment and won't have any wear.
Fantastic. I think I've heard from both John and Paul. I'm not quite sure which order. I'm going to pick up Paul first. WS2N, what have you done to solve the color printing problem, Paul? Because I'm guaranteed that you've seen some really beautiful space shots on your computer network as you're investigating what the European Space Agency or NASA or the Japan Space Agency is doing, and you'd like to have a hard copy in color. So how have you solved that problem, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
By the way, I'm looking at Staples as the printer I'm talking about for $29.99.
Wow. Paul, you got it.
But the one that, it's like the offspring of the one that I have. I have the Canon 190, and that probably went for about $45, I don't know how many years ago. And like Eric says, you buy the ink for about the same price. The only reason I don't buy a new one every time is, you know, a new learning curve. Yeah, I got to plug in the software, I got to go through a whole thing, so I just buy the ink, these things over and over again. But now they have it's offspring, $34, and it's a scanner and everything. You know, you scan, you know, make duplicates, copies, anything you want, color, black and white, the whole bit. The pictures, space pictures, they come out not quite as good as photographs, but pretty darn close. I was going to make up QSL cards like this one time. I have the Galaxy, as my QSL card. But then I needed a lot of them, so I just went over to Kinko's. Back to you, WS.
That's a good solution. That way you get some nice hard stock. The real stiff piece of cardboard, so to speak, to use for a QSL card, I think it would have trouble flowing through a tractor feed or whatever, or a printer.
But you can do it.
Okay, so you've taken a QSL card-like piece of paper, and you've made a color print of it on your printer, and is the color on that print secure enough? Do you have to spray it with some kind of fixative to make sure that if any moisture gets on it, it doesn't bleed? Back to you on that one, Paul.
Move out of the Stone Age, will you?
Okay. I'm a dinosaur. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Paul.
Have to do anything. It comes out pretty good. The only thing is that, I want to do both sides, and that becomes a headache, so. I mean, that's doable. So I just pour it over to Kinko's. It's more expensive than sending away for them. You know, I think it came out $1 each or something, but I got it like 50 at a time. It's inexpensive that way, too, but if I'm going to run it up 50 of them on my printer, in the long run, it'll probably cost me the same amount. But, you know, I'll go through a lot of ink.
Okay, Eric, you're about to grab me by the shoulders and bring me out of the Stone Age. So I should stop worrying about the ink bleeding. You're about to tell me that that color print on this $45 or $30 machine is going to be scratch resistant. I can send it in the mail and it'll arrive pretty looking. Bring me up to speed on all this, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. First of all, zinc formulation of the $29 printer is the same as the $400 printer, so you're dealing with the same ink. Really, it's more the material that you print on. I'm looking at this $29 printer, which is an HP 2540 all-in-one, which means it also has Wi-Fi in it, and I wonder if this thing has a scanner too. It does. Anyway, this particular printer is native 600 by 600. By the way, Dick, if you ever give presentations where you use an overhead projector and you want to make transparencies that go on the projector and pass them through your inkjet printer, just make sure you buy the transparencies designed for inkjet. Otherwise, you wind up with blob, because there's a version of transparencies that for laser printers that actually can take the heat and diffuse it. But, you know, the kinds of things that you're talking about, maybe if we were talking about this 20 years ago, we'd be concerned about it, but not anymore. K2IW, K2J.
Yeah, the viewgraph projector that you're talking about, now you're in the dark ages. All of the presentations I've gone to in the last 5 years, everybody's doing it with a computer-faced laser projector, laser light projector. DSP, DPZ, you know what I'm talking about. In other words, mounted into the ceiling of the conference room is a projector that projects onto a screen or onto the wall, and you hook up your laptop to it with your portable device plugged into it, and all of a sudden, if you've done it right, everything comes out. So very few people use viewgraph machines anymore. Walter Lewin does on his lectures at MIT on science, yes. Because he's got a whole lot of other motivations where he's blowing smoke across it to prove a particular factor about the Mie scattering characteristics of small chunks of smoke that comes out of his breath and so on. So it looks like the problem is getting a hell of a lot easier, Rich. It looks to me like the $500 or the $2,000 printer of yesteryear with high resolution is now boiled down to a very inexpensive machine with color, with scanning, with internet capability, and so on. So it looks like you've already got some suggestions. And for those kind of dollars, for a man of your resources, if you buy a $30 machine and you don't like it, and you have to buy a $45 machine 6 months later, not the end of the world. Those are inexpensive prices by my standards compared to the ham rigs that we usually use. N2EO, what a question you asked. K2RIW, very rich.
Comment, Dick.
Okay, yeah. John wants to make a comment. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, this is coming from dinosaur number two. There's one thing to look out for because Hewlett and a few of the other printer manufacturers used to do this. Now, Hewlett used to have date codes and a little chip on their printer cartridges that even if you didn't use them, and once you put them in the machine, they would sign off, and even if they were full, they wouldn't operate. That's a nasty. I think they eliminated that. But the other game they play is, many times the printer will be very reasonable. And if you look at the ink cartridges, they only have 25% of the volume on the initial cartridges until you buy the new ones. So you got to be careful. There's a reason for the cheapness sometimes.
No, I'm just trying to keep the brand ink.
Okay, and the input I heard, K2CX, sounds like... he's got some things to add to us. Go right ahead.
Oh, Dick, you know, I took the overhead projector for the Pro Magna computer guy, which was, you know, was something that you could relate to. But he's printing on a cellophane kind of thing. It's not an easy task. And dinosaur number two, that kind of used to be the case years ago, but you'll find that... this, like this particular printer uses a 61 cartridge to a packet. And I used to be concerned that that was the case, but when I got the printer, the same volume, same weight, and they do it by weight, by the way, as a new one that you buy from the store. So the first run of cartridge is, you know, a real cartridge. It's not one of those half things that they use.
That's good to hear. Thank you, Eric. KC2WGB.
I stand by your guide, Jude. K2CX is making a beautiful long transmission with no PL tone. A beautiful long transmission you just made, Steve. You did not have your PL tone turned on, and we didn't hear any of it. We heard your PL tone, and we heard you beautifully when you signed in. So reestablish your PL and repeat that whole message, Steve. K2 Charlie X-ray, K2LAW on the TechNet. Okay, I'm hearing you on the input, but you're not coming through the machine, Steve. Go ahead.
Now that should work, right?
Now you're coming through the machine. Now we're hearing you for the first time since your sign-in. Go ahead, Steve. You got it. It disappeared again. I'm glad you realized it this time. Give it another try, Steve. Okay, I'm hearing you on the input. You're not coming through the machine again. He's got a brand new transmitter that's got a nasty habit of turning off its PL tone unless he reinitiates it. Maybe if you stab the button that says PL tone on before each individual transmission, maybe you'll make it. I hope there's a way you can monitor the machine to know you're coming through. K2CX, K2LAW.
How do you hear me on this radio, K2CX?
Fantastic. Now tell us everything you want to tell us.
Everybody's, you know, always looking with a curious eye at the word of the printer and computers. Amateurs, many of us were the first people to start using the old Ataris and Radio Shack and Commodore computers from way back when. And the next thing you know, somebody made the printer. But anyway, finally, there was the remark regarding the printers and the cartridge devices. And this is where it is what it's all about. You find a more expensive machine, and the machines use all the same mechanics internally. You know, except for these very, very... Except for the very, very expensive printers that are... that are put together for, you know, plotting works and stuff. The same mechanics inside them. Typically, the same software from company to company with their own little flair with it. But one thing you see is that the expense of the machine or some of the frill things that it'll do for you, like easy double-sided copy and other issues like that. Come with the machine. But one thing you'll notice, and this is what it's all about, it's all about the sizes of cartridges. Yes, the inexpensive machines, you're limited to the amount of ink you can get in the cartridge. Yet the cartridges are still expensive. So they're not outrageously expensive, but they are still expensive. The bigger machines, you get a lot larger cartridge. Price per page of print goes way down. So if you're doing a decent amount of printing at home, that you can justify getting a higher end printer, have to check into the sizes of the cartridge and look into it, you'll find that your price per page goes way, way down. You charge them more for the printer and basically of the concept by buying and spending more money on the printer, you basically prepaid them some money for their ink. That's what it's about, getting as much ink into the machine per cartridge change and at the least amount of money. That's going to be your cheapest price per page. So how's that cost? Take to see it.
Darn good information, Steve. Before I lay down my money and buy a printer, is there an easy way I can find out how many typical pages of print that cartridge is for? I'm a little bit worried now that this is a well-kept secret. Okay, maybe Eric's got the answer. Eric, is there a way I can find out that brand A, model so-and-so, has a capability of 5,000 pages, and model J has got only 1,000 pages. Is there a way I can find out the level of printing I'm going to get out of that cartridge? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, if you want to look at specific printers, all the manufacturer specifications tell you how many pages it will do and how fast it does it. If you go to CNET.net, they list their sort of like the consumer reports of the computer world. They have their listings. If you go to Macworld, they have their listings. There's quite a number of places where you can get that and get the comparative differences between different manufacturers and different models. It's just a matter of how much you want to look, but that information's out there.
Okay, good stuff. Rich, it looks to me like your search is a little bit easier than you probably thought at first. It looks like there are inexpensive machines of moderate good quality and minor differences on how many dollars you pay and how many pages it's going to print, but you can make that comparison yourself. And so by way of internet search and by going to a couple of these good computer stores, I think you're going to find pretty much what you're looking for. Not going to be perfect. What else is new? Interfacing, it's always going to be a little bit of a problem. Learning its quirks to get a user-friendly machine that's easy to understand and easy to remember all the steps. When it comes to using my scanner, I've got a hell of a lot of problems each time I go through it. N2EO, K2RAW, go ahead, Rich.
KC2, MDP.
Steve, number 2, MDP, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick. There's a place I've been using for a couple of years, and it's called Cartridge World. And basically what they do is they refill the cartridges. I've had pretty good success, except for one machine, which was new, and they didn't have the software yet to refill these cartridges, because I guess some of these cartridges have chips in them or something. So what I would suggest is, now, if you're looking at a particular printer, find out what kind of inkjet cartridge it takes, go over to Cartridge World, you know, give the guy the number and see if they can refill them. You know, it's like less than half the price of a brand new cartridge, say at Microworld or a place like that. Back to you.
Where are they located? Are they right around here?
One thing that nobody mentioned is, how much printing are you doing? Are you in an office? Are you doing a business? Or are you just going to print something occasionally? And that should be the case. And Cartridge World is okay. There's one in Australia where I used to live. So, all right. Sometimes they mess up, but that's fine.
And when it comes to getting the cartridge to Cartridge World, can that be done by snail mail, or do you have to hand carry it there? What do you think, Rich? I mean, Eric? Say that again, Steve, Eric.
They do both. You can mail them, or you can drop it off and get a new one right then and there.
About that, sort of an exchange. Looks like your problem's a little bit easier than you thought, Rich, because looks like a lot of people are in your and my situation where we want a better printer. We're afraid to make the big leap to put our toe in the water. And it looks like the water's getting warmer and less expensive. N2EO for any of the fills, K2LAW and TechNet.
Okay, Dick. 2EO, very good. I didn't get what Eric said. Is Cartridge World located? I'm in Massapequa now. I hope they're right about here. I could mail them. That's no problem. Is Eric, I think you know, you're also running a Mac. And the Mac is USB 2, so I hope that whatever I buy, I assume they're all Mac compatible as well as Microsoft. And the last question is, Patricia has a Microsoft machine. Now, if I hook it up Wi-Fi, I don't think that's much of a big deal, I guess. That's why we can put it in a central location. She could use it too, I assume. Dick, I'll turn it back to you and to Leo.
AC2MDP.
Yeah, we're going to go to Eric and Steve in that order for those answers. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, then you'll pick up Neil, who just signed in. Look, Rich, today all the new stuff come USB. you're talking to Hewlett Packard, you know, you name the machine and they can deal with it. The driver in the Mac is going to be a little different than the driver in the Windows machine, because they're two different operating systems. But you're going to use it Wi-Fi, you download the little package for the Mac, and then when you open up print in all your various different programs, it will come up once you've installed the driver. It actually, all you have to do is run it, and it takes care of everything for you. And the same thing in Windows. It's a little different piece of, you know, executable software that then interfaces to Word and all the various different programs that you have that call for a printer. So it's really easy. You can't mess it up. It's a simple thing to do. And, you know, for the difference in cost, especially if you're a low user, the difference in cost between Cartridge World and HP is less agita and less aggravation. So, you know, that's entirely up to you. I'm going to throw it back to Dick. Dick, you throw it to the next person. K2IWK, you to adjourn.
Thank you for all that info, Eric. We're going to now pick up Steve and Neil in that order. Steve, KC2MDP, K2IW.
Thank you, Dick. Yeah, just for Rich's info, Cartridge World, there's one on Broadway. It's 565 Broadway in Massapequa if he wants to check it out. Back to you.
Hey, that's good to know. I guess it's a chain. Go ahead, Dick. Pick up the other station. And by the way, I'll tell you something I did with the Kodak that's interesting. I own a Collins 7584 receiver, which is a classic. It was rebuilt by Howard Mills in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. But the scale on the meter was faded. So what I did was I took the scale out of the meter. I scanned it on the Kodak. I brought the colors up, and I printed it out on photographic paper and stuck it back on the original scale with contact cement. You can't tell. It looks great.
Well done. Okay, I'm not quite sure who Neil is. Eric said that somebody wanted to check a name, Neil. Neil, please give us your call letters and go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet. I think when Steve checked in, I think Eric maybe thought it was Neil. Maybe recognized the voice. By the way, the previous guy before Eric, before Rich, was Tim, KD2AVU. And he was asking us quite a few questions about log periodics and other kinds of antennas. If you go to QRZ.com and you type in the call letters KD2AVU, Alpha Victor Uniform, you'll see some beautiful pictures of the log periodic he's building and a whole bunch of his other antennas. Hey, looks like an antenna man. He's my kind of people. Okay, let's see what Steve's got to say. KC2, here we go. K2, Charlie X-Ray, our technical advisor for the New York City, Long Island area, K2RIW. I probably have your title wrong, but you know what I mean, Steve.
Nance, call me anything. Just don't call me late to dinner. And let's see if this tone's going to set. I tell you, yeah, it had to do with, there's a number of different tones, and it's no longer just FM tones or FM repeater use. They have a short duration tone using CTCFF. Scratch my head. Anyway, what I wanted to do is, from a couple of weeks back, we were talking about half wave antennas and the lack of a need of a true ground plane on a vehicle, which would allow one to utilize such antenna on a fiberglass top vehicle that couldn't, unless you modified the vehicle, act as a true ground plane. And Rich and 2EO, we were all digging for the name in our past mind, but he came up with the name. And for all this time we've been talking about printers, I've now forgotten. I should have written it down. But if you remember it off the top of your head, I'm going to have to ask him real quick if he remembers the name. I have it in my notes, but they're not right in front of me. K2RIW, K2CA.
N2EO, give us that missing piece of information if you got it.
It was Rich UPS.
Oh, okay. It was a GAM. Is that correct?
Let's see if Rich, K2UPS Mobile. Let's see if he's on somewhere in the United States traveling. He's probably listening to us. K2 Uniform.